From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on June 20th in the wake of the mass shooting in Orlando, Florida. New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen was speaking in favor of a new law that would ban the AR-15. Shaheen said, quote, "That is a weapon of war. Somebody who is buying that kind of weapon is not buying it for target shooting. They're not buying it to go out and hunt deer. They're buying it to do bad things, and we need to recognize and address it," end quote. This came as news to the thousands of Americans who purchased an AR-15 in recent months, but Senator Shaheen said the point is that this kind of weapon is designed to do horrific damage, and it shouldn't be permitted any longer. Now, more than perhaps any other weapon, the AR-15 has become the most controversial and the most debated. Gun rights advocates say it's most misunderstood of all the weapons on the market. We know that most gun deaths in the United States are not caused by this kind of weapon, but reporter Mark Fullman of Mother Jones writes that, quote, "Attackers in six mass shootings in the past year alone have struck with assault rifles and ammo designed to kill en masse," end quote. All of which brings us to my guest this hour. John Stokes is a former Wired editor. He's the author of a piece about the AR-15 that has gone viral. It was published on Vox.com, among other places, and it's called Why Millions of Americans, Including Me, Own the AR-15. I've invited John to come on this program, discuss the piece, and answer our questions about the AR-15. And John is on with us now. Thanks for joining us, John.
Thanks, sir.
Now, John, we are hearing you through Skype, so it's sort of an in and out connection. I hope you can hear us. Can you hear us pretty well?
I can hear you guys really well. I can also, if this isn't working, I can try and go back and dial in through my iPhone.
I think it sounds pretty solid. Let's see how we do with it for now. A little bit more about your background, John. I saw a television station report that you self-identify as a liberal. Is that correct?
I do. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter. And I'm generally to the left of most gun owners. I'm not your typical right-wing gun person.
I suspect since your piece came out, you've had many people assume that you are not on the political left.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people in world circles that initially picked up the piece are not really necessarily on the political left, but they're civil libertarians. And so they're very pro-free speech and civil liberties. And for a lot of them, this includes the Second Amendment.
Well, what's perhaps most interesting to me is that in the piece that we've posted, by the way, you can find it right now on my Twitter account, Evan Dawson on Twitter. What's perhaps most interesting is that you reject some of the defense of the AR-15 we commonly see. You acknowledge certain facts while defending it. Is it a weapon of war? You say, yes. Is it preferred by many mass shooters? You say, it is. And we're going to get to that a bit later. But it seems to me that one of the reasons you wrote the piece is that you think the American media and the public is confused about what an AR-15 is and is not. So let's talk about that. You write the AR-15 is basically a giant Lego kit for grown-ups, and you add the following, quote, "The AR-15 is less a model of rifle than it is an open-source modular weapons platform that can be customized for a whole range of applications, from varmint control to taking out 500-pound feral hogs to urban combat. Everything about an individual AR-15 can be changed with aftermarket parts, the caliber of ammunition, recoil, range, weight, length, hold and grip, and on and on," end quote. So tell me about that, why you call it sort of a Lego kit.
Yeah, this is a really common analogy. I actually caught a fair amount of flack for that analogy, but I didn't make it up. In fact, I first used it in a Wired article after Sandy Hook in 2012, and I heard it from an AR-15 maker. It's a Lego kit because there are a lot of interchangeable parts that snap on and off, and you can change the weapon with very simple tools. You don't need to have a professional armor or a professional gunsmithing background. You can just change the weapon however you like. And this is part of the reason that this weapon is popular as a quote-unquote weapon of war. If you want to issue a rifle to troops or to a police department, you don't want to have to customize each gun for each cop or each soldier. It's a lot better to have a rifle that a soldier can just, say, change the length of pull by adjusting the stock, or change the position of a foregrip, or a cop can do the same. A cop can change calibers, so you get a lot of bang for your buck. It's a product of mass customization. So the fact that you can turn one of these rifles into a pistol, you can turn it into a long range useful. You can shoot small critters with it. You can shoot really large ones with it. This is sort of what makes it ideal for pretty much any scenario. In a previous era, if I wanted a rifle that was customized to suit my body, the length of my arms and the size of my hands and my height and stuff like this, I would have to go to a custom gunsmith and have modifications made on an existing rifle. The AR-15 lets me do that. And it's so effective that there's a guy who's a professional shooter who has no hands, was born without hands. And this guy is able to compete successfully with the AR platform because he can adapt it to his particular needs. So people with disabilities, people of different sizes, an 80-pound individual can shoot an AR just as comfortably as a 300-pound individual.
And you're right in the
piece. This is what makes it ideal.
I want to kind of build on one of those points because you're right in the piece, quote, in the pre-AR-15 era, if you wanted a gun for shooting little groundhogs, a gun for shooting giant feral hogs, and a gun for home defense, you'd buy three different guns in three different calibers and configurations, end quote. But, John, I've spoken to gun owners and hunters who tell me that a 22 can really do all of that. Why do you need an AR-15?
Yeah, a 22 can do most of those things. And, you know, frankly, it's also true that AR-15 buyers, they may actually spend more money on guns as a result of the AR because they get into customizing it if they had just bought two or three different guns. It comes down to a question of need. What is a need? Why do people need indoor? Why do people need pools in their yard? I mean, these things are also deadly. You know, it's one of those things where you could make do with something else. Obviously, the fact that the AR, the stock, is able to be customized, the length of it to fit my body, that doesn't necessarily make it more deadly. It makes it less awkward. And I suppose if I was out shooting a lot, if I was in a combat scenario where I was out in the field for a number of days and I was shooting quite a bit, then I would be deadly with the AR rather than in a scenario, a one-off scenario where I'm just kind of doing home defense or what have you, and I have a fixed stock and it's not really that comfortable, but I can make do. So people, you know, why do people buy a four-wheel drive truck if they're not going to go off-road, you know, but once in a blue moon?
Okay. You also write in the piece about the notion of home defense, that there are some out there who say, you know, this is an assault rifle, it's not a defense rifle, and you say we've got to dispense with that, that an assault rifle effectively is a defense rifle. And I understand the points you make in the piece, but for those who have read your piece, John, and they say they feel like there's an inherent difference between taking an AR-15 and using it to assault a target versus your home, you are concerned about an intruder and you want to defend yourself, they're saying, how can you quickly grab an AR-15 that might not fit under your pillow the way a smaller firearm would? Wouldn't a smaller firearm be more mobile, more quickly defensive than an AR-15?
Yeah, this is one of those things where it just comes down to the fact that it's super customizable. You can make an AR-15 that is as small and customizable and maneuverable indoors as a pistol. Some people prefer a pistol because they can shoot one-handed and maybe grab a child or something like this. There was a recent story in the news where somebody fended off a home invader with a pistol and they had a child in the other hand. So a suppressed 9mm pistol is, for a lot of people, the ultimate home defense weapon. Other people, they feel like hit very well with a pistol. That requires a fair amount of training. So maybe they find it would be easier to shoulder an AR. You can have a safe by your bed that just takes a thumbprint to unlock or that you can quickly open. I don't buy it because, again, the firearm, you can make it as short as you need it to be or as long as you need it to be.
Okay, and my next question is not a flippant one or an aggressive one. This is an honest question that I'm looking for just more data on. Have there been cases of home intruders fended off with AR-15s? I mean, is that – I imagine there's been some. I don't know of any offhand, but is there any sort of a common evidence that says people are effectively using an AR-15 in a home environment to protect themselves?
I see anecdotal. I follow a fair number of gun-related blogs, and so whenever there's a defensive gun use, especially involving an AR, the most recent one with a pistol, papers, they'll mention it. I have seen this off the top of my head. I can't cite a chapter and verse for you. Know how common it is.
Okay. Do you think in general that the media underreports successful home defense and successful defense with firearms, AR-15 and all categories?
Yeah, I think it's unavoidable for the main reason that, again, this is anecdotal, it's all that we have. Many defensive pistol and defensive firearm instructors will that most defensive gun uses don't discharge of a weapon. If a concealed carry holder or someone with a gun confronts somebody that's trying to do them harm, the person that's trying to attack them sees that they're armed, that often ends the altercation right there. The only time that we get actual measurable data on a defensive gun use is when the gun is fired and there's an injury or fatality and the police are called for whatever reason, and then we can register, oh, this was a defensive gun use. But again, anecdotally, and the best we can do, because people don't display a weapon to ward off an intruder and then go fill out a survey. Anecdotally, it seems that it's going to always be structurally underreported.
My guest is John Stokes, a former Wired editor, the author of a piece about the AR-15 that you might have seen on Vox.com or other places. It's called Why Millions of Americans, Including Me, Own the AR-15. And so, John, I imagine you'd heard Senator Jeanne Shaheen's comments that I opened the hour with, her comment that it's a weapon of war. Someone who's buying that kind of weapon isn't buying it for target shooting. They're buying it to do bad things, and we need to recognize that. What did you make of those comments?
Well, on the one hand, I agree with her. It is a weapon of war because you can configure it as a weapon of war. You can also configure it to do target shooting. So half of it is true and half of it is ridiculous. And part of what makes it a good weapon of war, a good issue rifle, is the same thing that makes it good for anything else. You can configure it to the individual soldier. The soldier has to go armor to have the length of pull changed, to have a foregrip readjusted, to have an optic adjusted or aligned, or an optic changed. The soldiers can kind of do this out in the field. They can change barrels and so on and so forth very, very easily. That's a good weapon of war. I heard on a previous program that you had, I went and listened to one of the previous ones on the New York State Act, there was a person against gun violence who made the common claim that this was designed for spray shooting, for just spray and pray shooting from the hip and just spraying out lead. And my answer to this is always, if this is what the purpose of this gun is, why would we give them to police? Why would a cop have a gun that's designed to just spray lead on civilians? That makes absolutely no sense to me. And again, that's not what it's for. That's not what makes it a weapon, the fact that you can just stand up and spray. That idea owes more to scenes from Rambo and First Blood and such. Where the guy is just standing there with actually not an AR-15, but a belt-fed machine gun, mowing people down indiscriminately. This is all Hollywood.
Okay. Well, before I get into, sort of the question of is it a weapon of war, and then the history of weapons of war that you write about in your piece, I just want to ask you a little bit more about the hunting, because one of our previous guests on this program who defended so-called assault rifles said that, look, he said, I'm an owner who I use it for hunting because there are animals that are pretty fast, that this is an accurate weapon with a lot of force and that it helps me hunt. He also said, my wife is not a large person and that she has an easier time firing it. And our listeners said two things. They said, first of all, is it sexist to say that women can't be trained to operate other firearms, that you need an AR-15. I mean, John, what do you make of that? Do people say, because you talked about the fact that it's lighter, it can configure, it's easier to handle for someone who maybe 80 pounds, that kind of a thing. But is it sexist to say that anybody, women included, if you own a firearm, can't be trained to use it properly?
Yeah, that would be sexist if you were to make that claim. Again, we get into the territory of what constitutes a need. Like, should people be allowed to buy the thing that best suits them, or should they buy something that is more awkward and that works less well for them in the name of safety? And the thing that gets skated over is that an AR-15, a New York Safe Act compliant AR-15 with a fixed so on, it's going to work well for somebody. There's the average build, there's an average frame and musculature and so on that gun is going to be optimal for. The only thing that the accessorization does is it spreads out that bell curve so that people of different kinds of builds and body types and sizes and capabilities and disabilities can use the gun as effectively the would be at the optimal point with a fixed set of features. And so, yeah, I think of course a woman can be trained just as well as a man of a different size build. If you just take two humans that have a similar build, whether they're male or female, they may or may not fit an AR-15 off the shelf. They may have to customize it for their particular build and their particular envisioned use scenario.
And when it comes to hunting, our listeners sort of scoffed at this notion that, you know, small varmints and AR-15, you know, it didn't seem all of that impressive that someone needs an AR-15 to hunt. But look, I'm not a hunter. So why don't you tell me a little bit about why you feel like this is a good use of the AR-15?
Well, I like the way that you put that. It's a good use of it. It's not a burning need. I mean, I can get a single shot bolt and I can go with hermits and critters. You know, just like I can ride a bike to work instead of a car. One maybe other respects and not in other respects. So hunting is a good, legitimate application of the AR-15 because I can take my AR-15 and I configure it to hunt a particular kind of thing. If I want to go hunt hogs at night, I can very easily add a night vision scope to the weapon. I can change the caliber so that it fires a larger 30 caliber round that may be more suitable for a large pig, although the regular 5.56 round does really well depending on which bullet type. I can maybe add a bipod to it so that if I'm shooting prone at some pigs, I can have an easier chance to hit them and to line up the shot. So there are things that I can do for that, and maybe I would take all those off. I would change the optic. I would remove the bipod if I was out deer hunting in the bush. So, again, I can adapt it for these different game types. Do I absolutely need to have the AR to hit rabbits? Well, no, of course not. In fact, if I was rabbit hunting, frankly, I personally use a shotgun, even though it's annoying to have to pellets when you skin the animal. But, you know, this is how I was raised, as we hunted rabbits with a shotgun quite often, sometimes a little rimfire.
Okay, and so let's move now to what I think was one of the points that you made that a lot of people are referencing about why you feel, and again, not need. I mean, I know you've even followed up your piece by saying you understand need might be taken out of context. That you're not saying, that you're saying we could live without AR-15s, but what you're saying is why civilians benefit from AR-15s, and that's reliability. And that goes back to the military. So I want to kind of work through some of the things that you wrote about that. First of all, I don't know how pro-gun rights advocates responded, but you say, yes, this is a weapon of war. You don't deny that at all. And I want to read from your piece there, and then we'll talk about it. Quote, "The AR-15 was originally designed as a weapon of war for man-killing and not for hunting or for target shooting. This is an obvious fact. But this is also true of most popular firearms throughout history, including your grandpa's lever-action hunting rifle. The vintage Henry lever-action rifle, the quintessential 20th century deer rifle, was originally deployed to devastating effect in the Civil War. With its high capacity, rapid rate of fire, and popularity with soldiers and civilians alike, the Henry was the AR-15 of its day, and it was followed over the years by the invention of the even more effective semi-automatic firearm, and then by a succession of long guns that we now generally take to be suitable for civilian use. My point in bringing up the lever-action rifle is that civilians have been buying, quote, weapons of war for a very long time, since the black powder musket days," end quote. Okay, so there's history, but I think a lot of listeners would say, number one, applaud the fact that you're acknowledging, okay, the AR-15 is a weapon of war, But then they'd say the comparison to, you know, the Henry and others, I mean, this is a different animal, isn't it?
It's on a trajectory of evolution. I think it's probably more deadly than the Henry in the sense that you can do faster follow-up shots with it, or with little training. Let me clarify. Somebody that's really good with their Henry can probably outshoot somebody that's mediocre with an AR-15. The AR-15 has, in the sense that it's ergonomic and lightweight and has all these nice features, it sort of was designed, and this is intentional, to lower the threshold. When it was introduced in Vietnam, one of support its introduction showed that troops qualified as marksmen at a much higher rate and with much less training with the AR than they did with the previous, I believe it was the M14. I think, frankly, and this is something that a lot of pro-gun people are squeamish about, all semi-auto weapons are ultimately, to one degree or another, they're at the optimal point for man killing, semi-auto and full auto. And so what I mean by that is if you have a weapon that stores a certain amount of ammunition, a number of follow-up shots, and you pull the trigger, and with each pull of the trigger, it continues to fire until that storage is depleted, whether it's a fixed magazine or whether it's something like the Henry that has or whether it's a detachable mag or something like the Henry where you load the weapon full of ammo and then repeat fire until it's done, even though the Henry's not a semi-auto. It's important when you're trying to kill people, especially in close quarters, but even to a certain extent far off, that you have the ability to make fast follow-up shots. Some hunters like this ability, some don't. Although nowadays I hunt with an AR like everybody else, but when I was raised, the hunting culture where I was raised, you tried to do a single shot kill, and you didn't really worry so much about follow-up shots and maintaining a sight picture and stuff like this. So I think in general, whether you're talking about a handgun, when you're talking about a rifle, semi-auto weapon, this is the development that was made not just for hunting but for actual combat. And the fact that we take them and we hunt with them is nice because they're convenient and they're reliable, just like people get in a Land Rover and they drive to the grocery store. It's a little bit of luxury, and it's a little bit of this is cool and this is really easy for me to use. But no, you can hunt with a single shot weapon. And in fact, I think if you never had an intention to defend whatever kind of a tactical purpose, maybe you would be fine with a single shot, a bolt action or something of that nature.
Okay, a different John on Twitter, by the way, says, Evan, please correct your terminology. Assault rifle is proper for a select fire weapon. Assault weapon is a political term. And you addressed that a little in your piece. What do you say to that, John Stokes?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I don't really care that much about that distinction. Some people do, some people don't. A lot of pro-gun people do. I think this is one of these battles that was lost a long time ago. I don't really like that hill to die on. Maybe that's not analogy given the topic of conversation. But I think that this business, I mean, sure, technically an assault rifle with select fire and has a certain number of features. It has a detachable magazine. It shoots an intermediate caliber cartridge, and so on and so forth. All these things get muddled up now. Assault weapon the term assault weapon is absolutely... It's invented for the purpose of legislation, of trying to ban something.
Okay, but John, I'm also curious to know why you think those who support gun rights and oppose new legislation, why do so many, and certainly not everyone, but why is there objection to the notion when people say a weapon of war? I mean, you yourself acknowledge it's a weapon of war. Why are we still getting hung up on that? That shouldn't be controversial, right?
I can see both sides. I mean, on the one hand, it's a very good Yale Law Review journal from the 80s. It's a classic called The Embarrassing Second Amendment. And this law professor sort of gets, I recommend it to everybody. You can Google it and you And the law professor brings up a case some time ago, I think in the early 1900s, where somebody was transporting a sawed-off shotgun in violation of the National Arms Act. And they appealed this case to the Supreme Court, and so the Supreme Court looked at it, and the guy's argument was that I should be allowed to have this sawed-off shotgun because it's a weapon of war. And the Supreme Court says, no, it's actually not a weapon of war. It's this weird thing. The Second Amendment doesn't protect it unless it's a weapon of war, because the Second Amendment mainly protects militia weapons and so on and so forth. So my point is that we've gone kind of round and round with this weapon of war business over the course of 200 and some odd years of jurisprudence. The time when the fact that the AR is a weapon of war would have meant to a large number of people that, oh, clearly this is protected under the Second Amendment, because the Second Amendment is for the purpose of arming a militia to protect against threats foreign and domestic. And so now we've kind of got into this situation where if you say it's a weapon of war, and people say, oh, well, it should be outlawed and it should be protected by the Second Amendment because, you know, really this is about hunting or what have you. So there's two camps within the gun community. Some pro-gun people will tell you, well, yes, it's a weapon of war because that's what I'm allowed to have under the Second Amendment. Whereas other people, they're deeply uncomfortable with that language, and they want to say this is a modern sporting rifle. It's just for deer hunting. Only things that are weapons of war are full auto. And so obviously it would be a ridiculous thing to say this is a weapon of war because it's not, or they make up some other distinction. So there's these two kind of camps, and they both contradict each other. Both are trying to defend their right to own this firearm, but one takes the route of claiming that, well, this is strictly a civilian weapon, and the other takes the route of acknowledging the martial heritage of the design and the martial purpose of certain configurations of the design and saying that's why.
All right, so let's get our only break of the hour. And John, if you could, just because we're sort of a little flickering with our connection, if we could switch to a phone line, that would be great. So let's do this. It's our only break of the hour. We'll come back with John Stokes. If you're just joining us, John is the author of a piece that you might have seen shared in a lot of different places in the last couple of weeks. It's called Why Millions of Americans, Including Me, Own the AR-15. And we had some listeners say, hey, why don't you have John on and at least explain some of the background of the AR-15, especially for those of us who maybe are concerned about it but don't own one. And so John is working through his piece, and we're going to be taking some of your phone calls and questions as well coming up. Let's get our break in, and we'll come back with John Stokes next. Coming up in our second hour, we preempt our regular plan for coverage because NPR National is going to be bringing you live coverage of the memorial for the fallen police officers in Dallas. That interfaith service starts live at 1:20, and you will hear it right here on your NPR station. That's coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. John Stokes on the line with us. We're going to get to some of your questions in a moment. Let me just close the loop on a couple of things. So, John, on the military history of this weapon, that is one of the attractive things to gun owners, as you explain in your piece. You write that this is simply more reliable, that it is less likely to break down, right?
That's right. When you have a firearm that's been deployed by the military, it's been tested. It's been tested and debugged by an entity, as I say in the piece, with the resources of an entire nation behind it. That makes it reliable, it makes it useful, and it makes it effective.
And so I still think there are going to be people who read your piece and say, are you really concerned with guns that are not an AR-15 jamming when you need them? I mean, are guns that poorly made that you can only rely on an AR-15?
All guns will jam. I have shot AR-15s that jam. Pretty much anything that fires, you're making an explosion inside of a tiny chamber. This is like a really high pressure. There's a lot of gas. There's a lot of lead and fouling. And guns are like a really dirty, difficult thing to get right because you're doing a series of controlled explosions, sometimes rapidly. There's a ton of heat. The barrel gets very hot on a lot of firearms, even after just a few shots. So it doesn't matter what gun you're talking about or how much you paid for it. At some point in your life, that gun is going to fail to fire for some reason.
Okay, and that's why you as a gun owner feel like you want the highest quality, the most reliable, and for you that's the AR.
Everybody does. If you're ever in a position where you need to fire your weapon, maybe you're on safari and you paid $20,000 to go shoot a buffalo. Maybe you are in a defensive situation, you're in the backcountry and there's a bear approaching you that's attacking you. Maybe you are in a home defense situation. Maybe you're out on the street and you're in a concealed carry situation. Whatever situation you're in, or maybe you're in a competition, the final stage of a competition that you've been training for a long time. When you pull the trigger, you want the gun to go off. You don't want it to jam. You don't want it to fail to fire for any reason. So everybody that shoots, there is no market for guns that are less reliable. There is literally zero market for a firearm that has a higher chance of failing to fire than some other firearm. The minute that people think that one gun is less reliable than the other, they switch to the gun that's more reliable. This is very in evidence in the handgun world where the Glock has taken over. Glocks are ugly, brick-like shooting appliances. They're not sexy. They're not attractive. They don't have the romance of a fine stainless steel revolver. A lot of guys like the 1911. A lot of guys like the revolver for various aesthetic reasons and ergonomic reasons. But people shoot Glocks because Glocks always go bang.
Okay, so reliability is a big issue as part of the defense of the AR-15. And that's also one of the reasons that you acknowledge it is a weapon of choice for mass shooters, right?
Yeah, that's right. If you're, you know, I hate to sit here and publicly try and put myself in the mind of a mass shooter. And I did this a little bit in the article, and some people just hated this. But, you know, I don't know how else you're supposed to understand a phenomenon, especially something as demented as mass shooting, without trying to put yourself a little bit in that person's shoes and understand why they make the decisions that they make. And I can tell you that because the AR pattern and the AR platform is popular and because it's reliable, a person can manipulate it under pressure. And if they're in a situation where they're doing a lot of firing and a lot of shooting and their adrenaline is high and amped up, and this could be a competition situation. It could be this is the same sort of set of the same set of circumstances of physical, physiological circumstances that you have in a three-gun competition are very similar to what you would have in a mass shooting situation, I would imagine, never having been in a mass shooting situation. But you're shooting at a series of targets, you're shooting under pressure, you're trying to maintain good sight picture, and you may have to troubleshoot and manipulate that weapon. It may jam on you in the middle of a string of fire. And again, this happens with the AR, it happens with every weapon. And part of what makes a weapon a good choice for you is when it jams, not if, but when the weapon jams or has a failure, you're able to troubleshoot it very quickly and with a high degree of effectiveness under pressure without thinking a whole lot.
Okay.
So I would imagine that this is why a mass shooter would select this gun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. It's hard to put yourself in the mindset there, but I think that's a fair analysis. And so here's a question from a listener on Twitter. Jenny writes to us, in his piece, he spoke of appreciation for its effectiveness and ease of use, the AR-15. That benefit also accrues to mass murderers. Does he believe that the risk to others of its misuse, thanks to easy availability, can be justified?
Yeah, this is probably, just to be honest, this is the hardest question for me personally to answer because there's a couple of things involved. I hate the idea of saying, well, you know, this is something that, I hate the idea of loss of innocent lives. And I would very much like to find a way to control access to really effective semi-auto weapons that would keep them away from would-be mass shooters and would-be terrorists without infringing the rights of everyone else. And so the question of is it justified, I think, is not so much a question of the AR, but it's a question, and this is what I try to do in the piece. I try to turn the conversation and say, let's back up from the AR a minute and let's talk about all semi-auto firearms. Especially most mass shootings before the recent spate of, frankly, the recent spate of AR shootings, the handgun was the most popular mass shooting weapon. And handguns were are very effective, just like an AR-15 is. More recently, you have the AR being used, but previously it was handguns. And the thing that the AR and the handgun have in common is they're both semi-auto weapons. And semi-auto weapons are designed for rapid follow-up shots on a target. So you can use them for spray and pray, like people say whenever they criticize the AR-15 as being designed for that. It's not designed for indiscriminate mass slaughter. It's designed for ease of use and for rapid follow-up shots on a target. But so is a Glock. But you can use them to spray into a crowd. And so the question that we all have to ask ourselves is it worth having civilian access to semi-auto weapons in general? Is the price of a possible mass shooting every now and then worth that? And I think that it is, for various reasons. But I would like to participate in a larger kind of conversation and debate about that rather than just focus on this one weapon design.
Okay, and I think it's also important to point out that if we are going to be serious about either gun bans, some kind of restriction, we have to use the word confiscation to be intellectually honest at times, and that, you know, we have to ask whether the toothpaste is out of the bottle in this country anyway. I mean, there are so many weapons currently out there that discussing a ban, I'm not sure, even to those who want it, I'm not sure how doable it is. But I do at least think the question, as hard as it would be to get there, is if we were to accept a society with or without semi-auto weapons, AR-15 and otherwise, should that be desirable? In other words, are the benefits outweighing the cost of having the availability that are with semi-auto? And at least, John, if we can have an intellectually honest conversation about the difficulty of a ban or the difficulty of confiscation, that it's at least worth discussing pros and cons or the benefits and the costs, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that we have to focus on the question of semi-auto, because what's happened with these bans is that these features get banned, and it's trivial to replace the banned features. California just passed a new assault weapon ban that declares that you have to have a fixed magazine. You can't have a removable magazine. And I understand why they did this. The idea is that you don't want somebody changing mags in the middle of a mass shooting scenario. So that's, if they could actually enforce that, maybe that would be a rational law. But the problem is that now there is a little $2 piece of hardware that you can get that you can swap out and retrofit your existing AR called the Bullet Button Reloaded, and that device makes your AR-15 California compliant. But with another little piece of metal and a spring that you can get for a couple of bucks, you can swap it back out and you can make it non-California compliant, and you could go shoot up a mall with it. So the idea behind the ban is, I don't necessarily even support it, but I think it's rational. The idea behind the ban is something that we could have a rational debate about. But the way that the ban works in practice is it's utterly ridiculous, because anybody can buy a California legal AR-15 now and then take it home and with an untraceable, unserial numbered piece of plastic and a spring, they can change that gun and to a pre-ban gun and then go do whatever they want to do with it. So logistics matter. And because these logistics matter when you're talking about features, I think a much more productive conversation to have in this country is, are we going to allow semi-auto weapons or not?
Okay, and so one more question from the host, and then the guests will have the rest of the hour here. You talk about the convertibility and all of the ease of use of the AR-15, all the different things you can do with configuration, et cetera. You understand that weapon more than most Americans. And certainly, I think it's fair to say that at least some non-zero percentage of mass shooters are not people who are fully versed in gun culture. Though, we can go case by case, and some certainly are. But if someone wants to get something that can commit a mass murder, they may not understand everything that you do about it. And so I think there's an argument that you make that says, look, you can't just ban an AR-15. That doesn't get rid of semi-auto weapons. That doesn't get rid of weapons that can have quick follow-up shots, etc. But if you start restricting at least some class of them, or even a portion of a class of them, that it might be more difficult to find black rifles, that kind of a thing, that maybe the idea is when somebody decides I'm going to go into a nightclub, if they are not convinced they can easily find something that looks like an AR-15, that maybe what they use is less deadly, that what they commit to get their aggression out doesn't kill 50. And look, I'm not advocating anybody kill 8 or 10 instead as if that's a good thing, but certainly if it's 50 or if it's 8, if it's 50 or if it's 6, then it becomes a discussion. And can we get there even with an imperfect kind of a ban? What do you think, John?
I think there are two factors at play. One is the fact that it's very easy to overestimate the difficulty of taking a modern firearm and tweaking it to get around a feature ban. Even a Glock is made to be disassembled for maintenance and for cleaning and for repair by an end user. It's extremely, there are weapon designs that are not as that you have to be a little more proficient to maintain, like the 1911 is a popular example. But modern polymer framed guns like the AR platform, the Glock, the AK are designed that the level of savvy, of know-how to make critical changes to these firearms is very, very low. I mean, it's just a matter of a YouTube video and 5 minutes and some cheap parts. So that's one piece. I think that it's a fantasy to believe that you can have a flavor of semi-auto, of modern modular semi-auto handgun or firearm on the market, and that you can ban specific features of that and not expect that someone will very trivially and very easily get around the ban, especially as things like 3D printing become more popular. That's a whole other discussion. The second thing is I think that a lot of the discussion that we have around fatalities, especially in a mass shooting context, is all based on what somebody sort of backseat quarterback thinks will happen. Like, for instance, the magazine capacity limit discussion is a classic example. Most people feel that it's common sense to limit magazines to 10 rounds instead of 30. Even many gun people seem to think that this is a no-brainer. But if you just go on YouTube and you look for AR-15 mag change, you'll find that even untrained people can change a magazine in well under 2 seconds. And with a little bit of practice, you can change a magazine in under a second. So, and that's one example. So I guess the point is that we require more data. I hate to suggest this, but there would have to be something like a mass shooting lab where you have people come in with simunitions and you make a fake nightclub and you would have to run different scenarios and you would have to actually try and figure out, well, what are the limiting factors for fatality here? And even that would be imperfect because fatality is a complex thing. It's about the bullet, the type of bullet. It's about the distance. It's about the sight picture, the visibility, ability to locate a target, so on and so forth. But if we could somehow simulate and gather data, we could probably make much more. If we were going to go down the route of trying to ban features, we could make a much more informed set of decisions versus some lawyer or some person who has no experience in firearms training or in combat, just sort of making up what seems to them to be a reasonable compromise.
All right, let me get a couple of listener phone calls. Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, I just wanted to respond to a couple of things, but one is the reason some of us get a little over-interested in the fact that these are combat weapons of war, is because in my mind I'm thinking, well, in the military, as far as I know, when they issue those combat weapons, there's training. It's for limited purposes and limited personnel, as far as I know. So there is some control there. When they're available to this civilian population at large, you don't know what you're getting. People that are not trained, they don't know what they're doing. They should not have a cap gun, probably. Okay, that's one thing. And the other thing is, I'm just curious, how do you store an AR-15 so as that it won't be stolen and yet have it at the ready to use? And that seems to be a problem that we've had in Rochester in several instances where we've had multiple shootings. Those weapons have been stolen.
Stolen guns, that's right, Jane. I go ahead, John.
Yeah, this is always a hard problem with gun storage, to take the second one first. There are a number of solutions that you can purchase. I've seen in one case a really fancy headboard replacement for a bed that is fingerprint activated, or some are activated by rings and magnets and such, that could quickly pop out an AR, but where it's hidden or where it's behind some kind of thumbprint lock. All of these are expensive. Gun storage solutions are expensive. And so it may be the case that a really sensible piece of policy and legislation would be, and you're going to use it, maybe we tax the ammo to pay and subsidize safe storage solutions. Or for whatever reason, maybe there's some kind of state-level subsidy for helping people to buy a gun safe and to buy a storage solution that's going to be suitable. You know, that's one example, because I do agree people need to lock up their guns. But when you have guns, trying to find a quality safe is a little bit of a nightmare. To take the one about training, though. So, look, I feel the way that your caller feels. Frankly, I feel that way about handguns. And handguns are responsible for some 90% of the shooting deaths in this country. The kind of person right now, with the exception of a couple of wackos a year that do these mass shootings recently, the kind of person that buys an AR is typically a fairly responsible person that is has resources and is going to invest in the platform and is not interested in committing a crime. These people, there just aren't that many crimes or fatalities with an AR every year. ARs, rifles in general, account for some 3 to 4% of handgun fatalities or homicides. I should actually be more specific, of homicides every year. And the AR-15 is some 14 to 15% of all rifles. And so you're looking at a very small number of rifles. I think I do share your concerns about yahoos with guns and people with no training packing guns around and shooting up whatever. To me, the low-hanging fruit here is the handgun. Once we find a way to address this issue with the handguns, then we can turn to the AR, because ARs, statistically speaking, are just not that big of a problem. And in fact, if it wouldn't be for the recent string of mass shootings where the mass shooters had discovered the AR for whatever reason as their new weapon of choice, we would still be having a discussion about handguns.
All right,
because that's where most of the guns are, and that's where most of the accidents fatalities are.
Jack writes to the program, Evan, great show. I favor stricter gun laws, and I want to thank you for having this guest. If this is the best defense of AR-15s, it should be clear to everyone that it's time for confiscation. But Mike in Rochester has a different take. Go ahead, Mike.
I think I just heard something that I agreed with on your show, on this particular show, when the gentleman talked about the need to pay attention to handguns first. I just want to give a few comments. Number one, your guest spoke of the AR-15 with, lovingly, I would say, as if it was a Lego or a carburetor or a car, giving comparisons to those various objects. It's not. It's a weapon. It's being sold as a weapon of war. The gentleman agrees that it is a war weapon. It is designed to deliver a large number of high-velocity bullets in a short time. One estimate, I think, was 45 seconds for a 30-round magazine. I could be mistaken about that, and then there's also various technologies that can advance that rate of fire. You fire one of those bullets, it goes through a cement block wall, and if you're in front of it, it goes through you. Now, there are many weapons, many rifles and handguns that are very powerful, but it strikes me that your guest is talking about this gun as if it is just, you know, an object or a tool.
And let me just jump in and let John respond, because we're going to run out of time. We got about 50 seconds, John. People have said when you compare it to a Lego, you're making the point for them that you're making it sound like a toy, and this is not a toy. What do you say to that?
I guess my response to this gentleman is we have to talk about all semi-auto firearms. All semi-auto firearms are deadly. All semi-auto firearms are ultimately sort of optimized for killing people. And do we want citizens to have that kind of firepower, to have the ability to kill other people, or do we want them not to have it? I think that it's a little bit silly to say, well, you should have a semi-auto weapon, but only a really crappy one.
I think people like Mike might say that it's time to say none to all of that. I mean, that's what I'm getting from people like Mike and from some listeners who feel like, you know, maybe that's where the conversation has to go next.
Sure. I think so. I think that it's time that we had a conversation about, are we going to allow citizens to exercise a natural right of self-defense? Are we going to allow them to keep man-killing hardware in their home as a sort of bulwark against tyranny, or for whatever Second Amendment reason?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that is the more intellectually honest direction that for the conversation to go. But John Stokes, out of time. The piece that we've posted is John's piece that people have been talking about. And I want to thank you for taking the time to join the program and answer questions, John.
Sure, thank you.
John Stokes, our guest for the hour. Short break and more next.